taking some of the pain out of divorce. When a couple decides to end their marriage, it often comes after years of pent-up anger, frustration, and hurt. This can lead to huge legal fees and pain and suffering, not only for the husband and wife, but for the children, other family members, and friends. I'm Keith Shortall. My two guests today are judges who have presided over thousands of family law cases. They've witnessed couples acting at their worst and, every so often, at their best. Andrew Mark Horton is a Maine Superior Court judge. John David Kennedy is a district court judge, and together they've written Do Your Divorce Right, Straight Talk from Family Court Judges, and they join me in the studio. We invite you to join the conversation. Email talk@mpbn.net, tweet @MaineCalling, post a comment or question to our Facebook page, or give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. Doing Your Divorce Right. This is Maine Calling. And we begin with a disclaimer. The judges are ethically prohibited from discussing any cases currently before them or any active cases. We wanted to get that out of the way and then say, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having us.
It's unusual for sitting judges in Maine to appear on programs like this or to write books together. You've done both. Why?
Well, 5 or 6 years ago, David and I were talking, and I said to him, I'm thinking about writing a book on family law, not for lawyers, but for the people who are involved in these cases. I think it would be a good public service. And he said, I'm thinking about exactly the same thing. And so the rest is history. We got together. We spent 3 or 4 or 5 years writing the book. We met for coffee every couple of weeks to keep each other on task, and Do Your Divorce Right as the end product. And we hope it's seen by our audience as.
So what Mark and I end up seeing typically is the worst of the worst,
right?
The tip of the conflict pyramid. And of course, those provide the best stories. So that's what we wind up talking about the most.
And one of the, one of the things that you point to as a typical recurring mistake is using the court as a means to exert revenge.
Right. One of the points that we make in Do Your Divorce Right is that no one should expect the court to vindicate them, to declare them right, the other person wrong. The court is there to solve problems and deal with what the parties are presenting. It isn't there to declare winners and losers. And that's unfortunately what a lot of people go into the process expecting and wind up not getting.
You cite in the book a case of a husband who comes in and he's done a lot of homework, all geared to make his spouse look bad in the eyes of the court. In that case, it can backfire, can't it? Because the judge sees this person's using all of his energy to exact revenge.
Yeah, it can backfire, and I think it usually does, but not always right away. I'm a big believer in the proposition that the truth usually or maybe always comes out. It doesn't always come out when it needs to, but it is very hard over time to sustain a web of lies without having a crack in the facade, or to keep that kind of, where somebody has really kind of tried to orchestrate the process and jam through an unfair result. It's very hard to sustain that over time. So I think it usually does come out. And when it does, the person's 10 times worse off than they would have been had they not done that.
I saw in my notes somewhere where criminal court judges see bad people at their best and family court judges see good people at their worst.
A lot of truth to that. Most of the people who come into divorce court don't have a lot of court experience, unlike some of the people who come into criminal court, some of them. And most people who come into divorce court really don't know what to expect. They don't, and this gets to one of the other mistakes that we see people making. they don't anticipate or understand the toll it will take on them financially, relationally, all sorts of things. And they may also not even understand the process. So we do see good people behaving badly quite often in divorce court.
There are cases, though, that surprise you, and people behaving at their best. There are those cases occasionally?
There are. And sometimes you will see, you know, the light go off almost. You can almost see it happen, where something will happen that somebody who's been a complete jerk finally just gets it, that the course that they're on really is harmful to their kids. And that's usually what turns it around. Then all of a sudden they begin to take the longer view and see the bigger picture. And those are hugely satisfying moments for us when they happen. And I'd like to think sometimes it's what one of us says, or it may be something else that they've observed, or it may be the co-parenting course that we've required them to take. But it does happen, and those are great moments.
I had one of those moments down in the Springvale District Court a number of years ago. I was doing day two of a very difficult contested divorce trial, and I had to interrupt the trial very briefly for two young people who were getting married to come into the courtroom. This was back in the day when you had to get a court order shortening the waiting period for weddings. And so I stopped everything in the divorce case. These two people came into the courtroom. And I have to admit, there was a little method to what I did, because I spent a few minutes asking them about their plans, you know, for the honeymoon, for the wedding, and so forth. And I approved the shortened waiting period for their wedding and sent them on their way. And while I saw the people in the divorce case watching and listening to all this, and their lawyers spoke briefly, and they asked me after the young people had left whether I could take a recess and give them a chance to talk. And I did, and they talked and came back with a settlement. And I'll always wonder whether for those kind of battle-hardened people in the divorce case to see people at the very beginning made some difference and caused that light to come on in the way that David just mentioned.
Have you ever seen a case where a couple is in the midst of a divorce and it's reached the court level and then decide for some reason to stop the proceeding and stay married?
Oh, yeah. That actually happens reasonably commonly. And you would be surprised. I don't know what the number is, but it is certainly not shocking to see multiple divorces and marriages between the same couple, you know, where they will actually go through and finish the divorce and then for whatever reason decide to get back together again. And then sometimes you see a second divorce with the same couple. And that can lead to really ungodly legal complications.
Because they already have an arrangement and now they have
It can be very messy.
Unfortunately, though, in most of those, most cases, the divorce goes through and there's the family is split up. And the oftentimes, sometimes the parents are relieved to be free of the difficulties that led to this divorce. But the children who had nothing to do with it are left to sort of figure it out. And that's really a difficult part.
Yes, I'm so glad you asked that. And, you know, we in an attempt in part to keep our book interesting for the non-lawyer user, but also kind of as parables, the book is sprinkled with stories. And one of the stories comes out of a case, a juvenile case that I was doing down in Biddeford, I'm going to guess 10 years ago. And the juvenile community corrections officer came in and recommended that I incarcerate, you know, a young woman who was pretty attractive and pretty intelligent and seemed at first glance to be quite, you know, well put together mentally, to Long Creek, the juvenile detention center, until she was 18. And this was not that correction JCCO's ordinary first reaction. He was very community-based corrections oriented. And so I said to him, what's going on here? And he said, this young woman has an intractable substance abuse problem. We've tried intensive outpatient treatment. We've tried inpatient treatment. We've tried therapy. We've tried group therapy. We have thrown every tool that we have at this, and it hasn't worked. And so the only way that we can keep her clean and sober is to incarcerate her. And he said, and it's all as a result of the parents' divorce. And meanwhile, both parents were sitting at either side of the courtroom, as far apart as they could possibly get, you know, glaring at each other. And I don't remember for sure, but I'm pretty sure she hugged each one of them separately before she was led away in handcuffs. And I have always wished that I had that MPBN was there and made a videotape of that, because it was such a graphic example of what can happen to kids as a result of their parents' divorce. And I'd like to show that videotape and say, see what you're doing? This could happen to your kid.
There were also cases, though, of families that stay together, you know, quote unquote, because of the kids. And that's not always healthy either, because they can it can lead to an awful home life. What do the courts have a view about whether it's good or bad, or is that just up to the couple and the family to decide?
Well, at least initially, it has to be up to the parents. They're the ones who have to decide together, because either one of them can opt out, obviously, at any time. They're the ones who have to decide together whether it's worth keeping the structure of the marriage in place for the benefit of the children. And the question, obviously, is whether whatever level of conflict or alienation exists in the marriage is going to affect the kids adversely, so that it isn't worth doing that. The best outcomes I can remember seeing, and this happens fairly often, is where the parents agree to get divorced. Whichever parent is leaving the home buys the house next door. That actually happened in a case. Actually, it may have been down the block, so that the kids were able to walk easily between the two houses and, in effect, have the best of both worlds. The parents were living as they chose, and yet the kids were able to maintain a strong relationship with both parents. And that's, if there has to be a divorce, that's the outcome that I think judges like to see.
And yeah, go ahead.
Well, we've been both doing this for about 15 years, and I think we would both say that human relationships are really inexplicable. There are good relationships that appear to break up because one person says the wrong thing at the wrong time, and it just tears it apart. And then there are relationships that, by any objective standard, you know, everybody would have been better off years ago if they had separated, and they appear to persist forever. But I guess so every parent that's thinking to themselves, should I stay together for whatever reason or for the benefit of the kids, has to make their own assessment. And one of the things we kind of counsel in the book is carefully assessing your situation. But one thing that I would say, and unfortunately we've both seen this, is parents should not stay in domestic violence relationships for the kids' benefit or for any other reason, because we know from the scientific studies that have been done that even indirect exposure to domestic violence by children who are present in the home literally changes the hardwiring in their brain, and is inherently really harmful. And so one of the things that we would say, and I'll use this opportunity to say it, if you're a domestic violence victim, in a way that keeps yourself safe, get to one of the domestic violence support agencies, and they exist all over the state, and consult with them, because you should not be staying in a domestic violence situation. It is inherently harmful to your kids.
All right, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, your comments and questions for Maine Superior Court Justice Mark Horton and District Court Judge David Kennedy. Share your thoughts. Email talk@mpbn.net, tweet @MaineCalling, post a comment to our Facebook page, or call 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
State Senator Bill Diamond has sponsored dozens of Maine laws regarding sex offenders. And now he's written a book about what he's learned, and specifically the challenges of investigating and prosecuting child sexual abuse cases. This week on Maine Watch, we'll discuss the issue of child sexual abuse with him, as well as Elizabeth Ward Saxel from the Maine Coalition Against Sexual Assault and Captain Mark Waltz of the Brunswick Police Department. We hope you'll join us for Maine Watch.
Join us for Maine Watch tonight at 8 and tomorrow at 9 on MPBN television, or tune in tomorrow at 12:30 here on MPBN Radio.
Come on, let's go somewhere. Let's meet the public.
You want to normalize it?
Yes, exactly. I want to meet some regular normals. Where are we going to find them?
Photo op.
On the next Fresh Air, Julia Louis-Dreyfus tells us about playing the Vice President of the United States in the new HBO series Veep. And we hear from the co-creator of the new Sherlock Holmes series on PBS, Stephen Moffat. Join us.
Join us for Fresh Air this evening at 7 o'clock. Broadcast of Maine Calling is made possible by MPBN listeners and by Husson University, committed to strong leadership through education, now offering the MBA, details at husson.edu, and by the Maine Association of Nonprofits, uniting and strengthening the nonprofit sector through management training and advocacy, nonprofitmaine.org.
And welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Keith Shortall. Today, a conversation about a difficult time in many people's lives, divorce. With me in the studio are two men who have presided over thousands of divorce cases. Andrew Mark Horton is a Maine Superior Court Justice, and John David Kennedy is a District Court Judge. They're the authors of Do Your Divorce Right, Straight Talk from the Family Court Judges. Join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. Email talk at mpbn.net. Tweet at Maine Calling or post to our Facebook page. We were talking earlier before the break about the divorce often being the first and only experience, and so there's a learning curve there. And many times, I would guess, people's knowledge of divorce is based on their recollection of an older relative, or maybe their own parents, or a friend who had a bad experience. But divorce has changed over decades. How has it changed since, for example, the 1960s, when many of our parents were struggling? Well, my parents, I'm in my 50s now. But it has changed over the years, right?
It has. And perhaps the biggest change is the level of resources that the court brings to bear on the divorce process. Back in the day, it used to be that people filed for divorce. The court sort of let the process unfold, didn't intervene or try to influence it too greatly. The divorce either settled or there was a trial. The court made a decision. People moved on. Today, the court brings to bear many resources that really did not exist and at least weren't applied systematically back in the day. One of those is what we call alternate dispute resolution. Every divorce case in Maine has to go through a process called mediation, where the parties sit down with a mediator who facilitates a discussion aimed at resolving the issues in the case. In domestic violence situations and situations where there may be mental illness or substance abuse, the mediation happens differently or perhaps doesn't happen in that fashion. But with those exceptions, people have to go through that process. The court also, in Maine and other states, has special programs for people involved in the divorce. One of those programs is the Kids First High Conflict Co-Parent Education Program, which is a program designed to help people who have had children together and who really, really, really are not getting along find a way to be parents together for the benefit of their children, even though they are no longer together as spouses or a couple. So that's probably the biggest change, I think, is the level of attention and resources.
There's one other philosophical change. If you remember any of the old movies that you see on Turner Classics where people had hired detectives to, lurk in the bushes and take pictures to manufacture evidence of adultery and what have you, In 1968, California adopted the first no-fault divorce law. And I think within about 10 years, every state in the country had that. And so that really was kind of a tectonic shift in the law.
That's sort of the introduction of the notion of irreconcilable differences.
Exactly. You no longer had to prove abandonment or adultery or some other, you know, serious physical harm. And that really had good and bad effects by making divorce much easier and much more socially acceptable. And the good effects is it's much more possible for somebody to get out of a bad marriage. And the bad effects can include the fact that there are lots more kids who are growing up in single-parent families than there were when we were kids.
1-800-399-3566 to join the conversation. Let's go to Tenants Harbor and John. Hi, John. Welcome to the program.
Hi. How are you?
Good, thank you. What's your question?
Oh, my question for the judges is, how much of the level of adversarialness in these proceedings is due to the attorneys representing the parties? And I guess another way of putting that question is, you suggest that parties come into this process and they're not really knowledgeable as to a likely outcome. If they're represented by an attorney, why would that be the case?
Judge Kennedy?
Well, I think, like everything else we're talking about, it depends is always the start of the answer. But in some cases, the conflict is driven by one of the parties. And in other cases, the conflict is driven by a party and an attorney whose kind of worldview is the same, and they're both in the high conflict mode. And then there are cases where one party or the other has picked an attorney whose style of practice, if you will, is the heavy-duty litigation mode, and sometimes it's that attorney who's driving most of the conflict.
One of the chapters in our book, Do Your Divorce Right, deals with a topic called the dark side. And we talk in that chapter about bulldogs, twerps, and sharks, our names for three categories of attorneys who are problem creators instead of problem solvers. And I think our experience generally is that 90% plus of attorneys are problem solvers. In fact, many judges around the state welcome the advent of an attorney into a case because if both parties are representing themselves, they may not really be able to communicate effectively toward resolving the case. They may not be able to have a good discussion about their issues. So oftentimes, having one or both parties represented exercises a very positive influence. But John, you're correct. There are cases where one or both attorneys in the case does raise the conflict level. That does happen, and it's unfortunate when it does.
If you see an attorney who's engaging in that unnecessary adversarialness and ratcheting up the strife, also I assume eating up the court's resources with the time it's taking to resolve the matter and hear the case, what can you do as a judge?
Very little. There is some element of coaching that goes on. And if a lawyer or both lawyers in a case are acting particularly badly, I may take a recess and ask them to come into chambers and remind them that we chose to practice law in Maine for a reason and that this is not how most Maine lawyers act. And that usually does what's necessary. But there are some people who are just plain resistant, and it doesn't matter what you tell them.
On the back of the book, it says one of the notes is it says learn how to impress a judge in a good way. How does one impress a judge?
Well, there are a number of things that you should and you shouldn't do, but most important is showing up. That's what I think it was Woody Allen said: 90% of life is showing up.
That's right.
I mean, if you don't show up, if you don't file your paperwork on time, you're going to get defaulted. And once you're defaulted, you're not going to have much input into what happens in the case. So
Woody Allen knows something about divorce, too.
Yes, he does. But the the strategy that some people, whether or not they're represented by a lawyer or not, of ignoring things and hoping they will go away is not an effective strategy. So rule number one is show up, file your paperwork on time, make sure you send a copy of your paperwork to your spouse or, if they're represented, the other attorney. The second rule is that everything that your mother told you in about first grade was right. Be polite. Come to court tactfully dressed. Judges usually don't want to see your tattoos.
Have you ever seen an inappropriate message on a shirt in a court?
Absolutely. And in fact, there's one that I can't repeat on the radio. But I was stunned to see a woman in a T-shirt which had a certain word spelled out in rhinestones on the front of it.
That doesn't help you in court.
No, that was not useful.
1-800-399-3566. We've got a button on the sensor button over there, so just in case things get too racy. Let's go to Penobscot and Joy. Hi, Joy. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes. Go ahead, please.
My question, I'm going back to what you said about domestic violence, and I can't agree with you more. My question is what the judges might have to say about verbal and emotional abuse, which, of course, is a lot of times a big reason for divorce. I have a son. He lives in Europe, and I think there was a big cultural difference. But anyway, his partner was extremely verbally abusive, and you know, I visited there when that kind of abuse was going on, and he took anywhere from 2 to 5 years to really, you know, try to decide about what to do because they had to have children, 8 and 5, and you know, I could see the difference as soon as they separated in a healthy way, in terms of my son's health. You know, he was always sick when he was in this marriage where he was always being verbally abused.
So does the court put as much weight on verbal or mental abuse as it does on physical abuse?
Well, I would say sometimes. And really the question is, what's the level and what's the intent? And one of the key aspects of domestic violence is the element of power and control. That is where one party is attempting to control the other party. And that can happen because of physical abuse. It can happen because of emotional abuse. It can happen because of verbal abuse. So if you're in a situation where you've really got a power and control issue that's being expressed by verbal abuse, then that's very serious. It can sometimes be very difficult for a judge to determine whether or not that's the situation that's in front of us because we never see people at their worst.
There's no evidence of a black eye or a broken arm.
Right. But again, my sense is the truth usually comes out over time. And one of the techniques that I use when I'm unsure is to try and keep people talking. I suppose I shouldn't reveal that. But the longer somebody talks, the more likely it is that the truth is going to come out.
The other point that people often forget and that often helps judges deal with issues where, as sometimes happens, both parties are accusing the other of being abusive in different ways, is for the parties to present email messages, telephone messages, and so forth. And you'd be amazed at what people write and say to each other in the assumption that no one else is listening. And a lot of that, my advice, I think all judges would say this, is to think, speak, and write as if everything you were saying and thinking was on the front page of the paper.
All right, we're going to take a short break again, and when we return, more of your comments and questions. Please stay with us.
Intelligence Squared U.S. invites the world's leading thinkers to debate today's most critical issues.
The internet doesn't change human nature. It just creates new opportunities for us.
Our minds are closing.
Do you think the internet is making you more narrow?
The motion up for debate. When it comes to politics, the internet is closing our minds.
We invite you to join us for Intelligence Squared immediately following Maine Calling at 1 o'clock. Broadcast of Maine Calling is made possible by MPBN listener contributions and by Northeast Delta Dental, administering dental benefits for businesses of all size in Maine, New Hampshire, and Vermont. Details online at nedelta.com.
And welcome back. I'm Keith Shortall. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, why you should look at divorce as a process, not an event. With me in the studio, Andrew Mark Horton, a Maine Superior Court Justice, and John David Kennedy, a District Court Judge. They're the authors of Do Your Divorce Right, Straight Talk from Family Court Judges. Join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. Email talk at mpbn.net. Post to our Facebook page or tweet at Maine Calling. I wondered when you set out to write this book whether you were concerned about crafting a manual on how to game the court system. I think you made reference to giving away some of your secrets. Were you mindful of that, or did you think maybe just having the information out was more important?
We were mindful of that, and if it's a manual in that regard, it's a manual on why trying to game the court system is not a good plan, because I can't say that we've seen it all entirely, but we've seen most of it, and we do see games being played, and most of the time they wind up not working and actually detracting from the credibility of the person playing the game.
One of the things that I would say we see most commonly in terms of gamesmanship is what we have referred to as the suddenly acquired income deficiency syndrome, and people will attempt to manipulate their incomes or their visible incomes downward, and that's very commonly done. And I would like to think that we're pretty wise to that.
The other thing we see often is that people will minimize the value of property in divorces that they expect to get and maximize the property. And I had a case where the husband had a set of tools and the wife had a set of Hummel figurines. And the husband's position was, my tools are all worn out, secondhand, nobody wants them, but those Hummel figurines are collector's items. And the wife's position was exactly the opposite. Well, I said to the parties, I believe in giving people what they value. And, sir, you obviously value those Hummel figurines greatly, so you're getting those. And, ma'am, the tools which you're putting such a high value on are yours, and I hope I'm giving everyone what they wanted.
How did they react to that?
The lawyers told me they made a swap about 5 minutes after they left the courtroom.
Which they are free to do, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. 1-800-399-3566 to join the conversation. Let's go to North Berwick and James. Hi, James.
Hi. Hello?
Yes, go ahead, please.
I'm in the process right now the problem, you know, we have a small child. We have a 4-year-old boy. And so we've gone through the hurdles of kids first. We've gone through the hurdles of mediation. And, you know, at each step, they're saying that if abuse is the issue, these things aren't really going to help you. So we get through it. And now we're at the last stage where we have a guardian ad litem in place. And it seems like we get all the way there. And now all the power is in this person's hands. And I am very nervous because my son's mother is very presentable, very like Judge Kennedy had said, you know, you don't get that sort of impression because they're on their best behavior. And she's very presentable right out of the box. But it's the issue of through time that the difficulty is, that's where the abuse comes through, and that's the difficulty they have. So my question is, what happens when this decision of the guardian isn't really in the best interest of the child? You know, if there's, you know, I've been being honest and open, and this guardian has been honest and open in saying that, you know, you're going to give me references that are going to show you in a glowing light. She's going to do the same thing. So it's kind of difficult to, I'm really nervous now of that we've gone through all these hurdles and all these issues just to get to this one person who has all the power to decide the fate of my child.
Judge Kennedy is not going to comment on your particular case, of course, as we said at the outset, but can you talk in general about the role of the ad litem?
I can. Well, I would say two things. First of all, guardians are tremendous helps to judges, and they can bring into the courtroom lots of evidence in their report that we need to know in order to make a good decision. So anybody who yourself or anyone else who's a litigant who's got a guardian, you want to make sure that the guardian is getting to talk to the people who you want them to talk to, and that they're talking to independent third party, if you will, neutrals such as school teachers, pediatricians, and the like. And that's going to make it more likely that they're going to ferret out what the real truth is. Secondly, despite what some people think, guardians do not have the last word. The judge does. And there are guardians who I respect greatly whose reports I have not accepted, and I've done something else. And sometimes I've taken a little of what the guardian recommends and used it, and sometimes I haven't taken any of it. And ultimately, while the guardian's appointed by the court, the guardian is another witness, and the final call is up to the judge.
Let's go to Liberty and Susan. Hi, Susan. Welcome to the program.
Hello, judges. Court name's Kennedy. Thank you for your book. My question is, it's about people who, for whatever reason, don't hire attorneys, and they come to court. And my question would be, what do you do as judges to help them prepare and present their case most effectively? Are there ethical ways that you might help, say, a person who's having trouble figuring out how to present the evidence or how to not be nervous, those sorts of things?
There are, and every judge in the state extends that kind of help on a regular basis. You have to differentiate between the kind of help that one side might get at the expense of the other party. Judges cannot do that, obviously, but every judge that I know of takes pains to explain the process, to help people relax, to point people to resources that might be available for them. In other words, we're very conscious that the courtroom is alien terrain for many people. We view it as one of our most important duties to protect the rights of people representing themselves. And every judge has techniques that she or he uses to make sure that justice is done and that people can find a way through the process.
Every now and then, I feel like saying to someone, would you please go buy our book? But I haven't yet done that. But, I mean, there's a very detailed appendix in the back about the rules of evidence and presenting evidence. So that's writing the book was one of the ways we wanted to do that. But I should also note that there is a website called helpmemaine.org, helpmelaw.maine.org, I think. And that there's an extensive amount of client education material for self-represented litigants that's been organized by Pine Tree Legal Assistance and the Maine Bar Foundation that's available online. And the other thing is that people can get an initial consultation with a lawyer at a reasonable cost through the Maine Lawyer Information and Referral System. And in our book, we at points recommend that if you can't afford to hire a lawyer, you know, as you're getting ready for trial, at least go do that and get a quick view from somebody who has a bit more expertise.
The book, again, is Do Your Divorce Right, Straight Talk from Family Court Judges. Let's go to Skowhegan and Jake. Hi, Jake. Welcome to the program.
Hi, I'm involved in a divorce family matter right now, if you will, where a protection from abuse order has basically been used to install a custody agreement in my divorce matter that was based on a fraud from the very get-go, an allegation of physical abuse that never happened. And a lawyer, you know, I assume when she, you know, gets to a consent hearing is going to say she forgot to send a correction to the court, which she also sent to me. I believe this is a misrepresentation on the court record. How does one, you know, really keep judges and lawyers honest in this instance? I'm representing myself pro se.
Yeah, well, again, we're not going to talk about your case here, but.
Well, again, without getting into the specifics of your situation, if anyone who believes that what is being presented to the court needs to be corrected in some fashion has the right and, in fact, should deal with that by writing a letter to the clerk. It should definitely be put in writing. And sent to the clerk, et cetera.
Copied to the other side.
With a copy to the opposing party or the opposing attorney. But judges obviously work hard on assuring that the information they're getting is accurate. And if it isn't, the best course would be to bring it to the court's attention immediately.
I really hate to discover that I've been lied to because it makes me very unhappy with the person who's lied to me.
And with that, we're out of time.
Okay.
Thank you, Mark and David. Thanks so much for joining us today. I'm Mark Horton is a Maine Superior Court Justice, David Kennedy, a district court judge. They are the authors of Do Your Divorce Right, Straight Talk from Family Court Judges. Today's program was produced by Jonathan Smith. Our volunteer, Scott McAuliffe, answered your calls. John Keimel ran the board. We had additional help from the MPBN web team. I'm Keith Shortall. You've been listening to Maine Calling on the Maine Public Broadcasting Network.